From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, reaction to Governor Whitmer's State of the State speech and her call for money to fix the roads from a Republican.
I'm looking forward to hearing, probably in just under 30 days, how we're going to finance some of these opportunities and look at where we're going and see the details of how we accomplish some of these.
And a Democrat.
The Michigan citizens have been asked to pay more and have met that challenge over and over again. The problem is that the last governor cut $1.6 billion in corporate taxes.
And Girls of the Crescent, teen sisters working to stock libraries with books about Muslim women.
We were really excited to do some research about Muslim women that we looked up to, but we couldn't find any books about them in the biography section.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let us come together to solve Michigan's problems. That was the message Governor Gretchen Whitmer delivered last night in her first State of the State speech.
And we must work together because we've got a lot to do. As I have said before, Michigan's problems are not partisan problems. Potholes are not political. And there is no such thing as Republican or Democratic school kids or drinking water. Our challenges affect us all.
The State of the State speech, of course, is where a governor spells out the problems she wants to tackle. Now, how to do it and what it might cost comes next month as she unveils her budget. We get reaction from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and some Michigan teachers, beginning with Senator Jim Stamas, a Republican from Midland. He is chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Senator, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. How are you today?
Doing well and glad to talk to you. I'm first interested in your overall impression, Senator, of Governor Whitmer's first State of the State speech.
I thought the governor did a very nice job. I think she came across very well, and I was very pleased that she continued to focus on the items that we've been working on over the last 8 years, which is continuing to make investments in jobs for our families, continuing to make investment in education for our children, talking about the roads, talking about fixing the auto no-fault as well. And so I think there was a lot of very positive conversations that I'm hoping we continue to work well together and make these a reality.
All right. Well, you head the Senate Appropriations Committee. You control the state's purse strings with that committee. So let's get your thoughts on a couple of the big priorities, two areas that she calls crises. Number one is roads. She pointed to the various metrics and studies that find Michigan has the worst or close to the worst roads in the nation. And as she said it, incremental fund shifts like we've seen in recent years don't fix the problem. Does she have a valid point?
I think that the additional dollars that we've been putting towards the roads is $1.2 billion. The challenge with the incremental funding is that in Michigan, these are the places that we can actually prioritize those dollars to go to it. But I do agree with her. We need a larger investment. I would love the opportunity to work with her in looking at where we actually find those additional dollars. I think the better estimate is approximately $2 billion for our roads. So I think it's we're headed in the right direction. We are making, I think, positive progress. But is it enough, fast enough? It's been 30 years, as the governor said, since we've had large investments into the infrastructure. And so I look forward to working with her to hopefully continue to improve our infrastructure, not only with roads, but across the state.
Do you see areas where you can say, yeah, you know what, we've got something we can work with here, area of compromise?
I think we're able to agree that we want to do that. How we take the dollars because of dollars being specifically specified by the voters of Michigan for schools or for other things, out of a $58 billion budget, there's only about $10 billion that is really left as general fund dollars that you can theoretically make a change in. But that means that we're talking about the $2 billion that goes to our prisons. It's talking about the money that we're sending to our universities and community colleges, and a lot of other programs that we've had in place. And so the revenue has been constant and is increasing slowly, but over the last 10 years, while the state has improved, our general fund dollars are remaining right around $10 billion for investment. So we're going to have some tough decisions, and so I look forward to that discussion.
Do you see any places for adding revenue, gas tax, anything that could bring in new revenue?
I know that the governor had put forward a proposal for gas tax, and so I think that's, you know, it's something that's going to be discussed, but I don't see that that's going to happen necessarily this year before we have the budget done. And so I don't know that we have that direct answer today, but again, we need to continue to look at how do we make sure the dollars that we're collecting are going to where the taxpayers expect it. And with our gas tax, we just had one a couple years ago, and those dollars are going directly, and that's where the incremental increases have been as part of that.
Let's shift over to another major crisis that the governor focused on, and that is our schools. Certainly, as we've seen, as the roads have declined, so has performance of Michigan school kids on so many important assessment tests and metrics. And one point the governor made that over the past 25 years, our state has seen the lowest growth in K-12 spending of any state in the nation, and she wants lawmakers to work together to fix the funding crisis. Those are her words, that's weakening our schools. What are your thoughts?
So I think that the studies that are being referred to have left out valuable dollars, whether it was school safety dollars, whether it was the additional $1 billion that we're using to pay down the liabilities of our teachers' retirements and others. They're coming out of separate pots and other dollars, and so they're not being counted as dollars going to the school. They're not dollars that are going directly to the classroom, but if you actually look at what we've done over the last 6 years within the legislature, we've continually increased the per pupil funding by almost $700 per pupil going directly to the schools where the schools are putting that in the classrooms. And so I think we both have an agreement, I think, that we want to do what proposal A did way back in the 90s, which was make sure all of our schools are receiving equal foundational allowance. And that's certainly one of my goals, and I think it's with hers. And I look forward to that chance to finally close that gap.
Throughout her speech, we heard the governor call for bipartisanship, for doing things differently in Lansing than what we're seeing these days in Washington. What would threaten that bipartisan spirit from your point of view?
Oh, you know, I think we talk about bipartisanship, and quite honestly, I think we do that. Unfortunately, the bigger issues that we have a fundamental problem are the ones that see all of the media. But I would argue that over 80%+ of the time, we actually vote together and we work extremely well together, and we have great communication and stuff. But I think that the fundamentals of how we get to some of these and resolve it is going to be a challenge, and so I look forward to the discussion, and I appreciate that the governor's putting a step forward to make sure that we have that discussion. So I applaud that.
Were there missed opportunities in last night's speech, in your view?
No, you know, I think that the governor put forward a lot of new ideas, and I wouldn't say they're missed opportunities, but there wasn't a lot of detail in some of them. And so I'm looking forward to hearing, probably in just under 30 days, how we're going to finance some of these opportunities and look at where we're going and see the details of how we accomplish some of these. And so I don't think it's a missed opportunity. I think it's an opportunity to see where we go and how we work together.
Midland Senator Jim Stamos, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Thanks for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Later in the program, we will hear from Democratic Senator Curtis Hertel Jr. of the Senate Appropriations Committee. We'll get his take on the governor's speech. And that speech also addressed LGBTQ rights. The governor called for expanding the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act to include protection for LGBTQ people across Michigan. Here now is Aaron Knott, the interim executive director of Equality Michigan. Aaron, how did you feel in that moment when you heard the governor call for that change?
I was very excited. Once again, Governor Whitmer is leading by example and doing everything in her power to protect Michigan's LGBT community members from discrimination.
Now, when she made that call to expand the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, Democratic lawmakers jumped to their feet. They gave her a standing ovation, and Republicans stayed in their seats. And after the speech, Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey spoke here on Michigan Radio, and when he was asked about that Elliott Larson initiative, here's what he said.
The Senate does not have any plans to take up and talk about Elliott Larson. We have far more, more higher level responsibilities and problems to solve. And this one, we shouldn't get caught up in the noise on it.
And House Speaker Lee Chatfield echoed that sentiment. And they're the ones that hold the power in the legislature. Do you think there is a way around this impasse?
Well, I'm hoping that we're going to break the logjam in Lansing that has left in an inclusive Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. It's languaged for far too long. And, you know, both the majority leader and the speaker are out of touch with the majority of Michiganders who believe that LGBT community members deserve the same basic rights to be treated fairly and equally, just like their friends and neighbors, you know, throughout this great state.
Aaron, are you aware through your work of any GOP legislators who do support this reform?
You know, we're working hard to build bipartisan support around pro-LGBT legislation. We're working in coalition with business leaders across Michigan to build that support. We're reaching across the aisle. We recognize that this is going to be an uphill battle. But I got to say, every day, hardworking people are losing their jobs because of who they are, and that's happening right here in Michigan. Additionally, municipal and state non-discrimination protections are crucial tools in the fight for talent, tourism, and investment. We need to allow employees to bring their full and authentic selves to work to ensure the best-in-class workforce that increases productivity and economic opportunity here in Michigan.
And, of course, the governor said last night, pointed out the fact she had signed that executive director banning state government from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Zero exemptions. Where can that go?
You know, when she offered that historic executive directive in January, a few short days later, the Michigan Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals followed suit by passing rules that protected court employees here in Michigan. And, you know, I would call on both the majority leader and the speaker to do the same thing for legislative employees. Right now, folks that work in our state legislature are the only employees that aren't protected from non-discrimination, discrimination and harassment.
Does this feel, with this governor that is seeing the need for what you've been calling for, does it feel like a new day?
You know, this has been a welcoming opportunity for all of us in Michigan that identify as part of the LGBT community. We're excited. We're standing tall with the governor. We're working hard to build a coalition. We're meeting with lawmakers. We're talking about the real stories of discrimination and harassment that impact our community disproportionately. I think that this is the opportunity right now today to pass from non-discrimination benefits that protect all Michiganders.
Aaron Knott, Equality Michigan. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Up next, we meet the teen sisters who started Girls of the Crescent, a nonprofit group seeking to empower Muslim girls through books and reading. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What do you do when you go looking for a certain type of book in your library and you come up empty-handed? No books fit what you need. Well, the Fewer Sisters, Zina and Mina Nasiri, you begin fixing that problem by starting a nonprofit. Here's the problem. Their library had no books about Muslim women. Their solution? A nonprofit group they founded called Girls of the Crescent. Zina and Mina Nasiri are from Oakland County, from Rochester Hills, and they're with us now. Hello, it's good to have you here.
Hello, Hi. Thank you for having us.
So, Zina, you are how old?
I'm 16.
And what grade are you in?
I'm in 10th grade.
All right, and Mina?
I'm 14, I'm a freshman.
All right, so you go to Adams High School.
Yes.
So tell us more about, Zina, what happened with kind of this, had a project, went to the library. What was the project and what happened?
So in fourth grade, we were given a research project. We were told to research about someone that we looked up to. And so we went into our local public library. We were really excited to do some research about Muslim women that we looked up to, but we couldn't find any books about them in the biography section. And so we realized that there was this lack of diversity and lack of books about Muslim women.
Now, that's a pretty deep realization for being in grade school. How did that, Zina, lead to you founding the Girls of the Crescent?
In February of 2018, we actually read The Lines We Crossed, which was the first book with the female Muslim main character that we read. And it kind of brought us memories back from fourth grade. And so that
inspired us to start our nonprofit, Girls of the Crescent, where we collect books with female Muslim main characters and then donate them to schools and libraries.
Explain the choice of that name, Girls of the Crescent.
So it took us a while to pick the name. We chose Crescent because it's the symbol of Islam and our nonprofit focuses on that religion. And we chose Girls because we're girls helping other girls.
So you're collecting books, Mina. Where do you get the books from?
We order them online. We did a lot of research to see like what books would be good for our list. And we have like a really wide variety. We have biography books and fiction, nonfiction. We have like a really long list on our website. And then we ask libraries and schools what books they don't have or what books they might want. And then we order them and then we ship them to the libraries.
Now, this doesn't come for free. So how are you paying to do all of this work, Zena?
So we have a lot of fundraising that we're doing and that we did do in the past. We did a cannon bottle drive in our neighborhood where a lot of neighbors donated. It was really nice to see all the generosity. We also have a lot of people donating on our website and a lot of authors that we contact donate their own books, which is really nice to see.
Now, I'm interested, when you go to a library, how do you approach the libraries? What do they say?
So we look at libraries in our district. We email them asking them to look at our list of books and see what books they have and what books they don't have. And they're always really excited about our cause.
Well, I think librarians of all people are the ones that are probably looking to open people's minds. And the idea of diversity has to be something that they really want to build into their libraries.
Yeah, a lot of librarians have said like they're starting a diversity section or they're working really hard to get more diverse books. And so when we tell them about our project, they're like, this is perfect for the time right now. We're trying to increase the diversity.
So this started about a year ago. Do you know how many books you've collected and distributed so far?
We've donated about 500 books and we've collected over $4,000.
Okay. And when you say libraries, are we talking school libraries, public libraries? Where are the libraries?
We've donated to public libraries and also like school classrooms, so the individual classrooms in the school.
Now, I have to wonder, I suspect both of you love to read.
Yes.
Okay. Did you have any idea how many books were actually out there? How did you start researching and discovering books about Muslim women?
We actually have a lot of people, when we tell them about a project, come up to us and they're really surprised about how many books there actually are. And they're like, oh, how can you do this if there aren't that many books? But they're actually a really wide variety of books. There just isn't awareness or availability. And we were surprised ourselves. Our list is really long and it keeps growing every day.
I did check your website out and you've got quite a great collection.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. You must be reading these as they come in, somewhere within all the homework time you have to do.
Yeah.
So start with you, Mina. Have you found a book that you just said, boy, am I glad I found this book?
Can I mention the one, the first one we read?
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Lines We Cross. The main character actually has the same name that I do. And like that was the first time I've ever seen my name in a book. And it was just a really fun kind of teen romance novel. But it also incorporated the religious part. And it was a really good book.
And what's Zena's favorite book?
That's definitely also my favorite book. But a lot of the children's books are really cute. There's one called Golden Domes and Silver Lanterns. And it's a book about colors. And it's really adorable.
What does it mean, and you started to tell us this, Mina, for you as young Muslim women to see yourselves in a book?
It feels really good. It kind of gives us a sense of like being included, I guess, in society, because if children grow up and they don't see themselves in the media or they don't see themselves in books, it kind of shows like they're not really included or they're not shown in the society. And so the first time we read a book with a character like us, it was just a really great feeling.
Yeah. And what were your feelings, Zena?
Very, very similar to Mina. We both really, really love reading and we read a ton. It just kind of never occurred to us that we were missing out until we read the first book. And then we realized that our whole lives we had never really seen that. And the other people were probably experiencing the same thing.
If you've just joined us, we are talking to sisters Zena and Mina Nasiri. They're from Rochester Hills. And when they discovered that their local library had no books about Muslim women or Muslim girls, they decided they were going to fix the problem. They founded a nonprofit group they call Girls of the Crescent, and their mission is to collect books with Muslim girls and women and get those books out into the libraries. And as you're doing this, at this point in our nation's history, you know that there is this sense of unease or even fear and hatred in this country toward some minority communities. How do you think of this work you're doing in Girls of the Crescent in kind of addressing this and promoting inclusiveness and maybe changing mistaken ideas that people might have about Islam?
The books that we are donating provide a window into someone's life that maybe someone isn't very used to or isn't comfortable to because they haven't personally met someone, like a female Muslim or just a Muslim person at all. And we've, both Mina and I, have experienced negative stereotypes toward us from classmates in regards to us being Muslim.
Like what?
Recently, it was near Christmas time, and so this kid was asking me, like, what do I do on Christmas? And I said, I don't celebrate it because I'm Muslim and I celebrate something else. And then I got called out. He called me something really bad, and it just felt horrible.
Have you had anything like that happen?
I had a person, a classmate, tell me that I was lucky that I hadn't had my hands cut off because I wasn't living in the Middle East.
How does that make you feel?
It's really disheartening, and it's just really unpleasant because you feel like you don't belong, and that people having these negative stereotypes are usually a result of ignorance, and it's an easily fixable problem if they're just educated, and it's just really sad that they aren't.
Yeah, so when you think about these books that you're putting in, you're sowing seeds, aren't you, that maybe some first or second grader, before these ideas are formed, may read that book. And at least, as you say, it's like opening this door. So this is really as much for young people who are Muslim, like you are, who wanted to see yourself, as it is for people who don't really know what it's about. Do you think it's even more for the people who don't know what being Muslim is about and don't understand Islam?
Yeah, I think that's a really big part of it. We're trying to like educate them, trying to show them like Muslim people and Muslim women. And especially, like you said, if children read about these books, if they see like a character with a hijab or a character from a Middle Eastern country, they realize like, oh, this person is like me. This person has similar experiences, and they don't grow up being ignorant. They don't grow up with those biases.
Well, you can learn more about Mina and Zina Nasiri's work by going to their website. It's very easy to find, girlsofthecrescent.org. Again, girlsofthecrescent.org. List of books, list of ways to get involved. And, you know, who knows what kind of seeds that you've planted now and where that may take you. Thank you so much for speaking with us about your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to dig into our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. It was on this day in 1855 that a new law in Michigan took effect. The purpose? To get around a federal law known as the Fugitive Slave Act. The effect was that African Americans in Michigan could breathe a little easier. Here now to talk about this 1855 Michigan law is Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thank you very much.
And from Battle Creek, we welcome the director of the Sojourner Truth Institute, Kimberly Holly. It's good to have you on Stateside.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Kimberly. This federal law, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, what did it do and why was it passed?
So essentially, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 sought to strengthen an 18th century federal fugitive slave law, which authorized local governments to capture and return runaway slaves to their owners. And it also imposed penalties on anyone that aided slaves in their flight. So the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was actually much more punitive. It forced citizens to assist in the capture of runaway slaves. It denied slaves the right to a jury trial. It increased the penalties for anyone aiding runaway slaves. And it also gave control to federal commissioners who were actually paid to return slaves. So this really emboldened slaveholders, and it created an environment where they needed to only claim that a black person was their slave for that individual to be recaptured. And it also endangered freed slaves who were now being abducted under this act and returned into slavery.
So, Rachel, let us look at Michigan in the early 1850s. How did Michiganders react to the Fugitive Slave Act?
Michiganders were somewhat split to this. You have to keep in mind that leading up to essentially 1855, when the law was passed, Michigan had spent about 20 years creating quote-unquote black laws. And these were laws that had been put into place to discourage free or formerly enslaved people from coming to Michigan. And so Michiganders were somewhat split on the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. Some people saw it as just absolutely abhorrent and a violation of the overreach of the federal government into state power. And others supported it. Others thought that it was perfectly fine.
So in 1855, here we have a state that's been around for less than 20 years. The Republican Party, abolitionist leading, is in its infancy. So in Michigan, who controls the legislature and who was governor in February of 1855? Give us the political backdrop.
The governor, newly elected governor, his name was Kinsley Bingham. He was a new Republican. The Republican Party was less than a year old when he was elected. And so he comes in. He was an attorney from New York. And the legislature is very young. They are very liberal. Lots of attorneys and businessmen. And more than 50% of the legislature is also from New York in the East Coast. There's actually only one person born in Michigan in the legislature at that time.
And Kimberly, for African Americans, for people who had, you know, gone on the Freedom Trail, they maybe gotten to Michigan and settled in Michigan hoping to build new lives, how did they react to when this Fugitive Slave Act is passed in 1850 and then in those years before Michigan took action?
Well, as you can imagine, the danger, I'm sure, was palpable. I mean, anyone was at risk of being captured. It was a really scary time, I would imagine, and you saw in other places where vigilante groups were being formed to try to combat or to circumvent or foil the attempts to capture slaves. And at that time, you started to have a lot of individuals run to Canada because of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. So it definitely had an incredible impact on blacks that had thought that they had made it to freedom.
So, Rachel, take us to 1855. On this day, this new law in Michigan takes effect, designed to thwart the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. What did it do on the ground level?
On a very basic level, the personal liberty laws that Michigan passed, they're actually two acts together, Act 162 and 163 of 1855. And the very basic wording is an act to protect the rights and liberties of the inhabitants of this state. And that term inhabitants is very important because it didn't say citizens. It was anybody that was living here. And on a very basic level, it makes the process of removing formerly enslaved people from the state. It makes it a very long process, a very difficult process. And Michigan wasn't the first state to do this. We were actually sort of on the back end of this. Maine, New York, New Hampshire, Vermont had laws like this. So on a very basic level, it made it really hard for anybody to come into Michigan and remove one of the inhabitants.
So there were new rules for local and cities and towns because certainly they would be interacting with bounty hunters or anyone tracking down formerly enslaved people.
Yes, these laws made it very community-based or local-based. So some of the things that these communities had to do was county prosecutors had to defend alleged fugitives. So if somebody was claimed to be a fugitive slave, the county prosecutors were required under these new acts to defend them. They also, an alleged fugitive, had the right to appeal the charge to a circuit judge. The bounty hunters or the slave hunters, they were not allowed to use county jails or prisons in Michigan to hold anybody. So that was against the law now. So these were the types of very local things that communities were now required to do. And a lot of communities had been doing it for almost 10 years at that point. This just sort of expanded it to all counties.
And how did Michiganders in general respond to the new Michigan laws in 1855?
It was pretty split. Most people were in favor of it. As I said, you have sort of the older generation of people who saw this as unconstitutional. And you also get this sort of interesting argument that this was actually an infringement on states' rights. So Michigan, people who are supporting these laws are using states' rights as an argument as to why Michigan or any other state should be allowed to pass these laws and protect the people living here. So it is split, but for the most part, people are in support of it.
Kimberly, Sojourner Truth, am I correct, had not at this point moved to Michigan?
Correct.
Was there any sense that Michigan having this new law, did that play a role in her moving to Battle Creek?
Maybe indirectly. Sojourner Truth was actually invited to Battle Creek the first time to speak. A Quaker settlement was in Battle Creek, the Friends of Human Progress, and they had an annual convention here, and she was a guest speaker. And certainly at that time, there were Quakers here that settled, that converted to spiritualism, and they had ideals, certainly anti-slavery, equal rights. And that environment, I think, fostered a more liberal environment that match the ideals for which Sojourner Truth stood. So I think probably indirectly, it certainly could have played a role.
When you think that here you have Michigan and, as you say, Rachel, many other states, Michigan kind of being on the back end of this move, specifically passing laws that are designed to subvert a federal law, how was that received in Washington?
Not well. So this adds to a longer list of national issues that are really exacerbating tensions between northern states and southern states. There isn't necessarily a direct link to the beginning of the Civil War, but it's these things over the course of, you know, 5-6 years prior to the Civil War that are just leading to greater tensions between the states.
One more log on the fire.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when you think about that, Civil War began just 6 years later. This was really a white-hot issue in our country. Kimberly, a little, if you will, about the Sojourner Truth Institute that you direct. What's the mission? What do you do?
So we're starting to focus more on an activist side of what does it look like to carry on Sojourner Truth's mission. So we're really excited. We're still a national resource. We get calls from people in different states wanting key facts or information about Sojourner Truth, and that's what we're here for. But we feel an obligation to also pick up the baton and carry on her work.
Kimberly Holly is from the Sojourner Truth Institute and Rachel Clark from the Michigan History Center as we mark Michigan's anti-fugitive slave act law signed into law this day in 1855. We want to thank you so much for a good conversation and for being on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll hear what teachers thought of the education promises in Governor Whitmer's State of the State address. Stay tuned. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We returned to the governor's State of the State speech last night. As you recall, we began today's show talking with Republican Senator Jim Stamos, who heads the Senate Appropriations Committee. We got his take on the governor's speech. Now we turn to Senator Curtis Hertel Jr., vice chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Democrat from East Lansing. Senator, what did you think of Governor Whitmer's speech? What jumped out at you?
Well, I thought the governor did an amazing job laying out the problem that lies before us. We've had 8 years of disinvestment from education. We've seen the disinvestment of roads for longer than that, and infrastructure in general. And if we're going to succeed as a state, we have to invest in our future. And our future is in infrastructure and our kids. And I think the governor laid out what those problems are well. And I look forward to working with her once we get to the budget process on trying to solve those important problems.
And since you on the Appropriations Committee are the ones who shell out the money, we're glad to get your thoughts on particularly what the governor said last night about schools. She called out previous legislatures and administrations for, in her words, pretending that little increases can fix an education crisis, playing a shell game with the state budget. How do you think this governor can and should work with the legislature to change that approach?
So, you know, you look a decade ago and what we were spending per pupil, we were one of the best schools in the country. Michigan schools were, and now we rank 40th in most categories. And a large part of that is the lack of funding that's gone into education. And I like the governor said, money doesn't solve every problem. But that being said, when you look at the fact that the state paid for a study, and that study said that we're spending less than $1,000 per kid in Michigan than what we should be spending in order to actually meet the cost of a quality education. And the state took that study and put it in a drawer somewhere and still didn't actually increase the funding for education. That should show you that we have not been serious. And every year we say, okay, well, we spent a little more, and so we've reached a record number spent. Well, I'm not sure if it matters what the record is. What matters is what the inflationary cost of everything to run a school is and what it actually costs to educate a kid and whether we're actually meeting those costs moving forward. Of course, you spend more money than last year. Inflation means that. I mean, that's just reality. But the idea that that we paid for a study. The study showed what we should spend. We still don't spend that amount. And we've been stealing money from the K-12 budget year after year by funding other priorities and basically treating the state budget like a shell game is wrong. And the governor's right about all those things.
And where do you think we find more money for Michigan schools, especially new revenue? Do you see any avenue toward that?
Listen, I will tell you this. I think the average citizen is tired of paying more in Michigan and getting less. The average citizen in Michigan saw their gas taxes raised. They saw elimination pension tax. They saw elimination of a lot of the credits that they got. They saw registration fees go up. The Michigan citizens have been asked to pay more and have met that challenge over and over again. The problem is that the last governor cut $1.6 billion in corporate taxes, and you look at the actual in Michigan last year in the general fund budget that is $10 billion, corporations paid $60 to $70 million. In six of the last 12 months, we paid more out to corporations than the average citizen got. I'm sorry, we paid more than they actually took in. So my thing is if we're going to ask citizens to step up to the plate, and they have, they're paying more every day. It's not like corporations don't benefit from good roads. They benefit from a qualified workforce. They benefit from having great schools and a quality of life that attracts talent and employees. We need to make sure that that they're paying their fair share as well. You know, one of my biggest problems with the last governor was that plenty of fee increases on individuals, plenty of tax increases on individuals, plenty of asking individuals to pay more all the time, but wasn't willing to do that to the business community.
So do I hear you saying raising taxes on businesses is?
I think they have to pay their fair share. I think that if we're going to ask the people to do it, and they have so, we should ask them to as well. Now I know that's a difficult conversation on the other side of the aisle, but I think that business can be convinced that they benefit from all these things, and Michigan's future is tied to this generation that we have coming up. They're the slowest generation to buy a car, the slowest generation to start a family, the slowest generation to buy a home, and it's hurting our economy. And if we don't invest in them, if we don't invest in Michigan's future now, we will all pay much bigger costs in the future.
And I want to get us to roads as well. Certainly our crumbling roads and infrastructure got a lot of attention in the speech last night. And when we talk about more money, we remember Michigan voters said no loudly, 80-20 to that ballot proposal in 2015 when they were asked for money for roads. Proposal 1, the most one-sided loss ever, proposed amendment. So where do you think the money could come from?
Well, first of all, that was a complicated proposal that was put to the people, and it wasn't just about roads, and that was part of the problem. As I think people were confused and angry that it wasn't just a road solution. But again, you know, we were working in the Senate on a bipartisan solution to the road funding problem. We were acting to get to the money that was actually needed by MDOT instead of what they did, which is basically make sure that by 2021 we have enough money, which, unless we're going to build a time machine with the 2021 money to send back to 2016, it's not going to actually solve the problem. We were working on all that in a bipartisan solution that would have made, for example, heavy trucks pay their fair share of their road damage. You know, the idea that, you know, a Honda Civic driving down the road or a Ford Fusion driving down the road does less damage than a heavy truck, that just seems to make good common sense to everybody, so they should pay their fair share as well. Unfortunately, that plan was not included in the final version. What the final version was just a tax on people. And again, people cannot pay all the costs of fixing Michigan.
So I hear you say, better come up with a better proposal.
It's not just a better proposal, but one that makes sure that people aren't the only ones paying. I mean, yeah. if heavy trucks do more damage to the road than everywhere else, then we need to solve that. We also need to solve the problem of the way funding structure happens to local roads. I mean, the reality is right now it's done by lane mile. And if you're looking around the state, if you're in some of the places that are less populated in the state and have less heavy trucks, their roads are much better than our roads here in my community, and certainly better than those in Metro Detroit. I had a colleague, a Republican colleague in the Senate, Tory Rocker, who stood up and said that our current funding structure is stealing. stealing from our populated areas of the state to give to other areas, even though the need is greater someplace else. We need to restructure the entire thing. And I think citizens want to know that if they're going to put the money in, that the problem is going to be fixed. I think I voted no on the last gas tax increase because I think if you're going to raise taxes, you should solve the problem. And we knew it wouldn't be solved the problem. The ultimate insult to a citizen is to ask them to pay more and not to even solve the problem that you're telling him you're going to fix.
Very briefly, Senator, what are you looking for from Governor Whitmer's budget speech next month?
Well, I'm looking at obviously we laid out a large amount of problems in the state of the state, and I'm looking forward to the proposed solutions. And that's really the way these things work. For, you know, I think a lot of people were saying, well, you know, the state of the state didn't have a lot of solutions. And what I can tell you is that I used to say the same thing about Governor Snyder's speeches, and that's what everybody says after the state of the state. In an hour-long thing, if you think you can delve into complex policy problems and provide every solution in an hour, you're crazy. The state of the state's job is to set a direction for where we need to go in Michigan. She did that last night. She proposed what the problems are. And in the budget, I expect to see detailed plans on how we're going to solve them. And I'm, for one, I'm willing to work with her to get it done. And that's, I hope my friends on the other side of the aisle are willing to do that as well. At the end of the day, these should not be partisan issues.
Senator Curtis Hertel Jr., thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
As it's very clear, education was a big focus for Governor Whitmer during the speech last night. She pointed to declining student test scores and childhood literacy and scolded previous legislatures for repeatedly raiding K-12 education funding to fill gaps elsewhere in the state budget. And she praised the teachers of Michigan.
I want to send a message to all the devoted educators across Michigan. You're not failing us. We have been failing you.
So what did teachers think of all of that? Let's turn to Stateside's education commentator. Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz is here now via Skype. And Matinga, before we get into the substance of Governor Whitmer's speech, let's talk a little about the style. How does her tone toward education and particularly toward teachers compare with what you've heard in the past?
Well, in my opinion, this speech was a lot less punitive as the speeches that I've heard in the past by governors and politicians. You know, a lot of times they talk about and they say that, you know, children are the future, but instead we end up hearing sound bites that turn into more homework for teachers. You know, they give you a huge, huge list of things that teachers ought to do to keep up with other countries. Like, example, like teachers are responsible for the social state of children today in the world, and we hear a lot of that. But to hear a politician actually say that, it's a huge admission of guilt here, to actually say that the responsibility does not necessarily lay on the teachers, but it does on the system, is simply mind-bending to me. It's just gobsmacking.
Yeah, in fact, I thought of you when I heard her say, our students and our teachers are not broken. It's our system that's broken.
Oh, for sure. This is a tone that sounds to me more like we have an ally rather than we have an evaluator.
Are you
right?
Yeah, I do get that. Now, you invited a few teachers from across the state to share their thoughts on the governor's State of the State speech. So let's get into what they had to say, starting with something that Governor Whitmer returned to several times last night, which is getting more funding and more resources into schools. Here's what Grand Blanc High School social studies teacher Nathan Reich had to say about that.
We all look at the things he's going to do, and anybody's in education, we're all like, yeah, that's not going to happen, or that's been said before, or it's not even that important to do. Like, you know, for me, the two things that jumped out were the preschool and then the counselors.
Kind of sounds like some frustration about maybe biting off too much. Nathan says he wants to see the focus be on counselors and preschool. What else do teachers think would really make a difference?
Well, you know, Nathan is a great example because, you know, he has a young family. And for him, the idea of having a preschool and, you know, getting his kids set up for success is very, very important. But, you know, this particular topic is kind of like a yes or a no for teachers. So, yes, yes, yes. She mentioned that, you know, she wants us to focus on skills, which gives teachers tons of permission to say, OK, let's focus on those essential skills and less on the sea of content that is included in the Michigan curriculum. But there's a no because. Because it, you know, as long as you keep assessing success by these test scores, you're really, you're discouraging the teachers from really changing pace.
The governor called last night for more funding 4K through 12. And she unveiled the My Opportunity Scholarship, promising 2 years of free community college for all graduating high school seniors in Michigan, or 2 years of tuition assistance at a four-year college or university. Do teachers think that actually might happen?
Depends. You know, Barbara Watkins, who's a principal at McGrath and at Anderson Elementary School over in Grand Blanc, she said that these promises were great. She loved especially the wraparound services, like the counselors and the nurses, et cetera, et cetera. But she also thought that, you know, how is she going to fund this? Like, how is this going to be funded? And how are the universities going to deal with the fact that half their budget is going out the window because people are going to be in for free?
And now let's move on to what teachers did not hear from Governor Whitmer last night. We start with Janice Cato, who's a teacher at Hemlock Middle School.
The big elephant of the room is class size. You know, you can add more in these literacy coaches, and they're wonderful. But if you have 30 kindergartners, you just have 30 kindergartners. Literacy coaches are going to fix it.
Well, aside from class sizes, what were the biggest things missing in your view from the governor's speech?
No, the class sizes is a big one, because this is the one where teachers are nodding when people are saying, yeah, you ought to do this and you ought to do that. But, you know, they are trained and they have the expertise to teach reading and to teach mathematics. But the problem is when you have 35 kids and you're trying to just assess and assist each one of them, it gets pretty crazy. And so we are not able to do our jobs. Our hands are tied behind our backs. So there's a big reason, like, why doctors do not have like 35 patients at a time.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Did you hear anything, Matenga, from the governor last night that touched on really changing what the classroom looks like, which is your area of special interest?
I sure did. She talked about, you know, project-based curriculum. She talked about really, really focusing on innovative ways and skills. She called it, I think, a path to skills, to higher wages. And that, again, it's permission to really, you know, rethink the way that we deliver the curriculum to the students, for sure. And teachers in Michigan have been wanting this opportunity. They've been wanting the opportunity to be allowed to teach in the way that they believe they can use their expertise to teach these kids.
One of the things you asked your teachers last night was what message they wanted to get across to this new administration and this new group of lawmakers. And here's what Melody Arabu, a former Michigan Teacher of the Year, had to say.
If you do not have a practicing classroom teacher as part of your decision-making process, then you are going to make decisions that will have negative impacts on kids.
So how will Michigan teachers, do you think, judge the success or lack of success of Governor Whitmer's education promises over the next year?
Oh, for sure. The one thing that we will be looking for is just financing, just budget. Like, how are we going to pay for that? Because that's when it turns into a reality. And to go back to Melody's point as to not have a teacher or an educator in the decision-making process is something that we're going to be looking for. We're going to be looking for that respect that she promised in the form of how much autonomy we have to practice our, you know, with our expertise, as well as we are going to be looking for noticeable changes in the school culture. Are we going to be seeing more support professionals, such as nurses and counselors? Is it going to change the way that is it going to take some of the stress away from the teaching profession?
Teachers in Michigan have certainly seen wave after wave of tinkering, of education reforms in our state that haven't really done much to move the needle on education achievement. In fact, that the assessment results are steadily sliding south. And you have talked to us on Stateside about teachers being frustrated, teachers leaving the profession. Did you hear anything last night from Governor Whitmer that makes you think the mood among our teachers might change based on her messages last night?
Well, just the admission that, listen, the legislation that we are putting and the systems that we're putting in place are the culprit of maybe our education not being the way we want it to be. I want to clarify that, you know, Michigan schools are not failing schools. They're being assessed by a failing system or a failing assessment system, like these test scores. And to me, that's going to change the way we think a lot, because what you're seeing sometimes in the schools is like a summary of bad policy on top of bad policy. Well-meaning, but it's bad policy on top of bad policy. And the bad policies are never scraped off. They're just added and added and added. And then we wonder why the foundation is so wobbly.
Hall of Fame teacher Matinga Ragatz is Stateside's education commentator. Matinga, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and all week long we've been asking, what do you think is the most romantic spot in Michigan and why? Let us know. You could hear your answer on air. You can leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. Give us your name, where you live, and your response. Again, 734-764-7840. Or email us, stateside@michiganradio.org. Again, what is the most romantic spot in Michigan and why? Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Katie Raymond. I'm Cynthia Canty. Stay warm. Thank you so much for listening.